What if one person's story had the power to completely change the way you see your own life?
Today's guests have lived through unimaginable loss, incredible resilience, and somehow come out the other side with a mission that can help the world.
This is a conversation you definitely don't want to miss. Welcome, everyone, to this week's episode of Talk to Me, Sis. Lise and I are beyond thrilled to be welcoming two incredibly amazing women who also happen to be sisters and are the co-authors of an amazing new book titled Chosen Warrior. We are thrilled today to have Georgie Davis and Rosanna Shack with us on Talk to Me, Sis. Welcome. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We are thrilled that you are here. To give a little background and context to our listeners and our watchers, Georgie and I have been dear friends for 20 plus years now. Georgie's husband, Artie, is the pastor of our church, and Rosanna is Georgie's sister. Georgie grew up in Liberia. Her parents were missionaries, Henry and Doris Hungerpiller. And before Georgie was ever born, the Hunger Pillars adopted Rosanna as their daughter. But that is a very long, interesting, and complex story. So I'm going to let these beautiful ladies take the wheel. And before we get into the book, which is the main focus of our talk today, we want to hear a little bit more about your family background and how you all came to be sisters.
Thank you very much for having us here on this platform.
Yes. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. I will introduce because I am the big sister.
Yeah.
In fact, I was 5 and a half years old when Henry and Doris Hungerpiller took me into their home. Mm-hmm. And I lived with them along with another Liberian girl for 4 years or so before Georgie was born. So I'm 9 years older than Georgie. Mm-hmm. And her parents were my parents and Rebecca's parents before she or Bertie and her, because she was his second daughter. Yes. And because Rebecca came to the family first, and when Bertie was born, Rebecca and I discussed that this baby sister was going to be her baby. And if mom and dad had any other children, the next one would be mine. And so that's how Georgie became my baby sister from the day she was born.
So were you a little mother, Rosie, to Georgie when she was born?
From the time Georgie was born, through elementary school, we came to the States when Rebecca and I were seniors in high school. Right. Georgie and Bertie were in elementary school, but I was always her guardian angel, let's say. I wouldn't let anything happen to her. I felt responsible for everything. And when she got married, I was in Liberia and she was in America, in South Carolina. I said, I have to meet this man. If he's not good, I'm going to take my sister back.
And we're happy to report that Artie is very good.
He turned out to be the best. He's the best husband, and we have been really satisfied with him.
Yeah. I love it. Artie's getting a good review. Artie's getting a 5-star review. Yeah. I love that. Yes. I love that. Rosie, there was a very specific reason why the Hunger Pillars adopted you.
When I was born, I always say I was born with the odds stacked against me. Mm-hmm. My biological father was very disappointed that I was a girl and not mm-hmm. a boy. He wanted a son.
Right.
But I had already come. He couldn't send me back. And so he had to, you know, keep me. But when I was 2 years old, I got sick. My mom was coming from the market one day, and running to meet her, I fell. Mm-hmm. And when she scooped me up, you know, she tried to wipe off the dust from my face, and my skin was burning hot. Yeah. And that fever lasted for about a week. And after the fever subsided, I couldn't use my right leg.
Right.
And this is strike two against me. I am now a child with a disability.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. My mother, you know, mother's instinct, we always, no matter how ugly, how deformed or whatever, we are born, you know, we have a bond with our children. And yes. My mother would seek every opportunity she had to find help for me. And being traditional people, she took me to sick bushes where we had traditional doctors, herbalists. And one of them told her that a dragon has swallowed my leg. And that was right. So disheartening for her. And everyone believed it because I could not right. use the leg.
Right.
So I
right.
only had use in my left leg. So I would pull myself around the yard, hop around. And one day she was listening to the radio and there was an announcement that this Christian radio station had opened a medical clinic. And she said, oh, but then I want to take my daughter there.
Yeah.
And when she took me, you know, we went and standing in the door, we saw this white man behind a microscope. And when he lifted his head, he saw us standing in the doorway and he, you know, asked her, what's wrong with your pretty little girl? Oh. And she said, well, I came to look for help for her because a dragon swallowed her leg. Mm-hmm. And so he got up and came. He looked at me, looked at my leg, turned it and stuff. And he said, no. It's not a dragon swallowing her leg, but this is a sickness that's in the world these days. And he went on to tell her about an American president who had the same sickness, but it affected his both legs. Yes. And he was president of the United States in a wheelchair. And my mom, you know, it was shocking to her, but he said, right. you know, since I came to Liberia, I have noticed that men do not treat women very well. And this little girl, if she, you know, stays with your family, she will not have a bright future. And I'm a bachelor right now, but I'm due to get married. And when I marry, I want my wife and I to take her into our home and give her an opportunity for an education. Because who knows, I mean, once she's educated, she could not only help your family, but she could help Liberia. And that was prophetic talking, you know,
so as prophetic. I look back.
And I was a very shy child, you know, growing up on a missionary compound, growing up with white friends and white classmates, you know, that went on later on. But that's how I got into their family. And true to his word, when he got married, he and his wife came to visit my parents. And right. I was sitting in the sand cooking crab legs in my little pot with peppers and spices and everything. And they talked to my parents and they looked at me, smiled at me, and then they left. Well, after a few weeks, maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks, my dad calls an older cousin and says, Lucy, Kripakwe is going to the missionary people today. So get her ready and take her. And Lucy bathed me and we went. I'm asking all these questions and she's saying, you will see when we get there, you will see. And we got in a taxi cab and when we went, the taxi put us down at the main road and we walked towards the beach and the coconut trees, the ocean roaring and all of that was just so excited. And we went to this white house with green paint, you know, frames around the window.
Right.
The windows and the doors. And I met the lady at the house and she welcomed us. And Lucy put my bag down and said, okay, I'm going back. Her boss said I should bring her. Here she is. And she left. But when I looked beyond my new mom, I saw this other little girl, my age, and she spoke Basa, my tribal language. But my mom and dad had an interpreter, an older girl, to interpret Basa to English and English to Basa for us so we could communicate. With our parents. Mm-hmm. And that's how I met Rebecca and we bonded from the beginning, you know, and that's where we started.
So Rosie, I have so many. Were you crying? Did you miss your mom? Because your mom sounded so loving. She was looking out for you and you were five and a half. How scared were you?
You know, as I look back, I wasn't afraid because
Wow.
one, I had seen this lady before.
Okay.
And the second reason was I met a girl my age there and
Yeah.
we communicated well. And
Right.
this was a new experience. And, you know, traditionally in Liberia, and I'm sure this happens in most parts of Africa, families exchange children.
Okay.
Like if my mom had a sister that could not have children of her own, she would take one of hers and she would give it to that other sister
Sister,
and say,
okay.
this is your child. And so,
Okay.
you know, it's ingrained in us that whoever is the parent figure for you is your parent.
Okay.
And but because I met Rebecca there and I had seen our mom before, I didn't really cry for my mom. It was a new experience. And, you know, the first thing Rebecca told me that really had me so excited, I didn't even think about my home I had left, was our mom has sold 100,045 dresses for her. And she made some for me. And, you know, I'm not even looking at my new mom yet. I'm still, you know, very, very astonished with Rebecca and what she's telling me. And she said, let's
Right.
go to the room. We have our own room.
So you couldn't even imagine
Our own room. And when
room
she
and
opened the
dresses.
closet, I see about a dozen dresses, according to her, was 100,045. And
I was going to say,
these are mine and these are yours. And my dozen dresses were there. And our mom was a seamstress. So she sold all of our clothes almost like twins. And so
I
we
love
grew
it.
up as if we were twins.
I really do just want to say, like, it is incredible to think that Mr. Henry had the vision and the foresight and to be an advocate for women and take you
Yes.
little girls in and make a future
Yes.
for you. That's incredible
Very
at that time
good.
in history. I mean, that
Yes.
really is an incredible thing.
What do you
Amazing.
Mind, Rosie, if I ask, like, what year was this when you were 5 and a half? What year we were in?
I was born in 1956. Let's see what I have, maybe for 61. Towards
Wow.
the end of 1961.
Wow.
So Georgie came along, and just briefly before we get into a little bit of later life, tell us about growing up in Liberia, the two of you as sisters, just
Okay.
so our people can get a mental
Yes.
picture of what it was like.
Growing up in Liberia for me was, you know, I didn't know any other place. In
Right.
fact, as a child, Liberia's structure was patterned after the United States because
Okay.
of our history. You know, freed slaves wanted to go back to Africa, and born free black people wanted to go. And so the American Colonization Society, you know, facilitated in them going back. But the settlers had their settlements named after the places they came from.
Okay.
And when I was born, my parents were not from the coastal area. They were from the forest. We were the forest people. They were hunters and farmers and warriors. So you can tell from the name of my book, we didn't name this book until the last, I think, 4 or 5 months before we published, because I couldn't come up with a name that really represented what my life represented. And so I came from the indigenous, the people that were met in this, you know, new country that settlers came to. The seal of Liberia carries the emblem, the love of liberty brought us here. And so that speaks to those that came to Africa. But my, you know, grandparents and heritage was from those who were met there. So
Amazing.
Liberia was, you know, we will say civilized culture.
Right.
But we being indigenous people at home, before I came to the Hunger Pillars, we spoke our tribal language, Bassa.
Bassa.
We have 16 tribes in Liberia. We are from the Bassa group. And because we didn't know English well, we started school at a small village where some black missionaries had a school so we could learn English and learn classroom and stuff like that. And then later on in that year, We started school with the missionary kids at ELWA. So I had two cultures. I had the indigenous culture, and I had the American culture. I grew up not knowing really where do I belong. Do I belong here or do I belong there? So I had to switch depending on where I found myself.
Or who you were with. Yeah, that makes total sense. Yes.
So to this day, can you speak Pasa, or have you lost that?
I lost most of it because I wasn't speaking it, you know, like I did as a small child. But when I got married, I had my first daughter who had a disability. She was born with microcephalus, a small brain, small head. And I could not get a nanny to take care of her because of all the superstition, you know, our people believe in witchcraft and genies from the mountain and, you know, those things. So my biological mother, Ma Sarah, came to be the nanny for her. Her name
isn't that crazy?
Is Diana. And, you know, we'll talk about it later.
Yes.
You
know, yes, that's an incredible.
So my mother started speaking Basa to me and my children, and I started picking it up, but not as good as I speak it now. And that we will discuss later too.
Okay. Love it. Georgie, you had the very unique experience of being born as a white person in Liberia to your missionary parents. Tell our listeners a little bit, what was that like? Because we've talked about that so much in our friendship gatherings about you really do feel, I'm like, Liberia is your home.
It's interesting because even though Rosie and I grew up in the same household, it was, we had different experiences when we were younger because at the time my parents were at a missionary compound where there were mostly white Americans.
Okay.
And so she went to the American school and she, you know, learned all the American ways.
Yeah.
But when I was born, I guess from when I can recall, it was probably, I was 4 or 5, and they had moved off of that compound and had joined another mission. And this other mission, the missionaries were all Black American.
Okay.
And so at my parents, the compound had a school. And so I grew up with all Liberians.
Right.
So when I was learning, I'd never learned American history until I was an adult and came to the States and I was teaching my kids, which was very interesting. So I grew up with, you know, Liberian history, and I grew up, my fond memories are running in the swamp and these little African boys put me on their back because they didn't want my feet to get dirty. And of course, I wasn't supposed to be in the swamp anyway.
Right.
And, you know, and my mom had strictly said, don't go in there, but
and
we
there
did.
You were.
And, you know, I grew up feeling like a queen, like I was a princess, you know, because most of our friends were boys, African boys. And so, you know, they would put me on their back and take me from, you know, one island to the next in the swamp. And, you know, we would sit outside and eat boiled snails in a can over a little fire and, you know, and eat those. And so, and I grew up speaking what they call it, Kolokwa, which is the Liberian English. So Rosie actually knew more American English than I did until I was teenager.
Yeah,
so
interesting.
Yeah, had a different, and so just like she said, as an adult, you sometimes feel like, where do I belong? Because the difference was, here I'm a white American kid, but I really feel that I belong with my African friends. And then, with my Liberian friends. And so whenever, you know, coming to the States, we would come to the States every 4 years. But it wasn't until, I guess, I became an adult and came where I feel this. I started to feel lost. Where do I really belong? I don't really belong here. I couldn't tell the jokes. Nobody would understand. People used to say, you never laugh at anything. I said, well, I don't really understand your jokes, you know?
Right. It didn't make sense. Sure.
Mm-hmm. So for me, I kind of buried all of that. So there's a term That was, it was coined like in the 1950s. And it's become more of a popular thing now. It's called Third Culture Kids, and it's TCK. Okay. So we are Third Culture Kids, and it's not just missionary kids, but, army brats or mm-hmm. embassy kids, or not even just someone who grew up in a different cult. So different culture than your passport country, but, a lot of people feel that way, even if they just grew up in one place. Something in their life was different, and it makes them feel like they don't really belong. You know, it could have been like family dynamics or whatever. So there's, so this is a term that's become more popular, and there counseling and schools that you can go to help kind of. Not rectify, but
work through it.
Work mm-hmm. through it. Yeah. Exactly. So anyway,
it's fascinating when you think about the realities of that. And we've talked a lot about it a lot in our mm-hmm. friend group, how mm-hmm. that has been a struggle for you over here and learning to acclimate to American life, even though you've been here a long time.
I was 17 when I came to live here. I came by myself. My biological sister was finishing up high school in Africa, in a neighboring country. And I had been here about 2 months, and we got word that she had drowned at the beach on her senior outing. Oh. So it was, that was difficult because I was here by myself and we both spoke the same, English, and we were going to go to college together. Mm. And so that was really a difficult time, for me to be here. And then, we lose our sister.
Right.
But I've been back and forth through the years. Yeah. At least,
Oh, wow. And so at 17, who were you staying with here? Who was, because you're not.
My husband's, I'm sorry, my dad's sister, my aunt Elizabeth, in South Carolina. So that's how we ended up in South Carolina.
Exactly. My dad is South Carolina. And then you have this unimaginable, tragic loss of your sister. Were you able to go back?
I went back for the funeral, but I was in school trying to finish up. It was just for a short time.
And you came right back.
And I came right back. And then I met my husband soon after.
Right.
And we got married very young. I was 18.
Wow. Yes.
But he was my saving grace because, I was here all alone and God just was so grateful. I'm so grateful that God brought him into my life.
Brought you together. Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. Okay, so Rosie, so you have over in Liberia, you have also gotten married and had children. And as we talked about off camera before, kind of the tie that binds us all is you share the experience that Lisa and I have had of having a child with a disability, which you briefly mentioned earlier. That was your first daughter, correct?
Yes. I didn't realize that something was wrong with her until she was 5 months old. Rebecca was getting married and she and I went into town for a hair appointment. And when we got home, Mom and Dad were standing in the yard, their faces showing that something was wrong. And she said, "Rosie, we had to take Kiana to the hospital because she was convulsing." Well, to make a long story short, she was diagnosed with microcephalus and she had to be on medications and all of that. So after 2 years after she was, born, I had my second baby. I had just gotten a job with this iron ore mining company. You can imagine I graduated nursing school in March of 1979. I have this baby that's sick.
The thing that I think that Rosie has in common with, Lise and Nikki, your stories are really the same. You've been handed something. You've been handed lemons or you've been handed something that you didn't know how to deal with and you weren't expecting. And I think your journeys are probably very similar in having to navigate that and push through that and figure out you know, how is this going to work? How's it going to affect my life in the future? And the thing that I think is really neat is Rosie, later in life, she was able to affect thousands and thousands of young women and girls, and many who had a disability. And the same with you girls, because now you're here affecting thousands of people and encouraging so many moms who are, you know, facing what you faced, and you're being such an encouragement. I think it's just really cool how God has just worked That's that amazing. Out, and he used, you know, the troubles that you all had. He uses the things that we think
for good.
He uses things that we think are, you know, should not have happened to us or whatever. Yes. So I just think that's a thread that kind of goes through.
It is a tie that binds for sure.
It is. And it feels good to, you know, because I know, thinking back with me, not comparing anything to, you know, the environment in terms of the country, the unrest that you had to deal with on top of your personal life, what was going on. It just feels good to know, when I felt so alone, or just remembering the valleys that I was in, if we can do just support, lift, make someone not feel so alone now, today, pay it forward, that's helpful. But Rosie, what's really intriguing to me is your biological mother had you.
Me too.
And you had this disability. And the fire she had in her belly to make your life better, take you to doctors, or, you know, the healing bushes, or wherever she would take you to try to improve your life. And then your first child, now you're that mom wearing that t-shirt and you're navigating, I don't know, and then it brings your biological mother back. Did you align later in life, or like have a new level of bonding with your biological mother irony of how that all came together.
Yes. I bonded with her again. Even my kids bonded with her. She taught us Basa, you know, and she even taught me how to cook Liberian food. My husband's friends used to laugh at him because I cook spaghetti, I cook this.
Yeah, you're so American. So American.
Yes.
Hot dogs, cheeseburgers. Yeah.
It was just a doing of God, because it goes back to what Daddy has said. I was not going to only help my biological family, but I was going to help my country.
Yes.
She made sure that I did not forget who I was. And then a lot of times I would question, but why me? Why did I have to have polio? Why couldn't I wear nice high heels, sandals, and shoes? You know, like we say in Liberia, bluff. Like, you know, other young ladies, I can only wear certain types of tie up, you know, shoes that support my bad leg, my foot. Yeah. And why did I have my baby? She's so pretty. Why did she have to be like this? You know, but the first few years of her life, I said, God is punishing me that she's like this, because I didn't want the pregnancy at the beginning. I had wanted to have an abortion, and the doctor said no. And I was saying, but if God knew she was not going to be good, he should have, you know, let me have the abortion. But I loved her going through the process of labor. I appreciated mothers. You know, I was a nurse. And when I was in nursing school, I had never seen a natural delivery before. And so this one day, I asked the midwives, I said, please let me just observe before we do actual, you know, deliveries ourselves. And when I went in the delivery room and I saw the baby's head crown, you know, and when their face popped up, I yelled. And they said, gasp. I said, no, I beg you, I won't make any noise, you know. But then I appreciated.
Yes, it's a miracle.
This is my little angel God gave me. I'm going to love you with everything. You are not a punishment to me. And when she did pass away, almost 9 years old, I came and met her dad. I came from work. And her brothers and sisters were out playing. My sister had gone to buy something at a shop nearby. She didn't move, so she was in her crib. But I found Gus when I come from work, the first thing was to go and greet her. Yeah. And I went calling her name, you know, and she wasn't moving. And when I realized she was dead, I just started weeping and sobbing. And I said, oh, I wanted to be here when you took your last breath. I was there when you took your first. I wanted to be when you took your last, and I would cry. And people were wondering, but why is she crying? The baby couldn't do anything, you know. I said, you don't know, but she was the love of my life. Her siblings loved her too, you know. And
Every life matters.
And yes, it made me be able to encourage other women that would come to the hospital with kids with needs and stuff. And I would say, you know what? I have a baby like this, so I know what it means. When we started our organization and started shelters for children, we made sure to take and give valuable care to children with special needs.
What, so it's something that, what an incredible gift from God. I mean, yes, how, yeah. I mean, and Mr. Henry knew that you were going to impact people. And isn't it so funny how God does it in the most unexpected way? He sends you this thing or this person that you just are so, that you love with your whole heart, but you don't know what to do, but he ends up using it for good. It's just amazing. So yeah, so Rosie, tell us about, you know, you become a mother, you're working as a nurse, you're married, and then the Civil War happens.
Really, the war didn't just abruptly happen. Mm-hmm. The civil unrest in Liberia started with a coup d'etat where our President Talbert was assassinated, and then the military, the army took over. And they were there for about 10, no, not even 10, 5 years. And then the leader of the military group decided to resign from the army and become a civilian and ran as president in elections in 1985. Well, the elections were rigged. He became president. And because of our tribal divisions, there was a lot of unrest. And by 1989, Christmas Eve, rebels, there was an incursion from Ivory Coast into Liberia, the northeastern part of Liberia. And we said, oh, the government has everything, because, you know, on the radio, national radio, they're saying, oh, there was an incursion. 100 men, you know, had come in and it would be crushed. Well, it was not crushed. And that stretched on for 14 years.
Wow.
In fact, Georgie was talking about the first 6 months. By April, May, the different countries started, you know, evacuating their citizens from the country.
Right.
Because it became so horrific. Mom had Shauna and Sharmina to leave with the other Carver missionaries in May. She left later. Dad left in June, and we were stuck. Because I was Henry Hunger Pillar's daughter, I was automatically made the head of Carver Mission. I had not lived there. I lived way 250 miles, you know, away, but the war had brought me back. And so here I am. I find myself the leader, a shy person like me, you know, and I'm looking around. God, what do I do? You know, it made me a person of prayer. Then I realized, I said, you know, Moses had the whole children of Israel that were looking at him for direction, looking at him, what do we do? Oh, we are hungry now, there's no food. And Moses, and I felt that, you know, and I'm saying, oh God, how do I navigate? Then my mind ran back to my daughter, Kiana. What if Kiana was living in all of this turmoil? You know, God saw it in advance and he took her to lessen that burden on me.
On you, yes.
You know, and then I appreciate it. I said, okay, God, I accept that she's gone. She's at a better place with you. But here I am. I am Moses to this group.
You are.
And there were 33 people that I was meeting, including my children and my biological parent, my mother, my stepdad, my sisters, you know, other people from their little community came to Carver to seek refuge among 200 people in our school building. Well, ELWA across the road, the compound I grew up on, had 22,000 internally displaced people.
Wow.
And I would go over, because I was a nurse, you know, we were doing like public health training so we don't get cholera and, you know, to control sanitation. And one day, I think it was on the 25th of July, we just see everybody rushing. No, on the 24th, everybody's rushing out of the compound. And they're just like ants, you know, in a drove moving. And so the displaced people in our school building, some of them started packing and going with them. So I called a meeting. I said, I don't think we should leave. I don't feel we should leave. Because before Daddy left, he said, if the spirit leads you, follow. If you feel a burden in your heart that you have to move, move. If you don't, stay. And I said, for me, I want to trust that the tip of the angel's wing is going to cover us tonight if Joel and his men bomb ELWA. The angel will protect us. But let's sleep because it will soon be dark. I don't want to be where I don't know where we are. I can't see what's around me. And so our group remained until the next morning. And so by 7:30, we had prayer as a group. And we had a Sierra Leonean boy whose name was Mahmoud. And I said, we have to change your name because the ECOWAS, the West African states, had sent in, you know, people to help protect the government. And the rebels were killing people from those countries. And so I said, please, we will call you Moses. I said, everybody, his name, don't call his Mahmoud name, call him Moses. He said, no. My mom and pa gave me that name. I can't change my name. I said, he said, no. I said, okay, since you want to keep your name, don't talk. You are deaf and dumb. I will do the talking, you know, and we left not knowing the person we were not thinking of at all was one of our teachers, a Nigerian. And when we got to the first checkpoint, some of the students from our school had joined the rebel faction and were pointing out people as people were passing through the checkpoints. And they were saying, that man over there is a Nigerian. And those rebels dressed in dresses, wedding dresses, you know, had their long wigs and everything. They came and circled him. Bambangida. Bambangida, you know, that was the Nigerian president's name. And, you know, I'm in shock. And I said, no, he's not. He's a teacher from, he said, this, shut up. We don't know book. You know, education is called book. We came here to get rid of all of the enemies. He's a Nigerian. And so he says, this, Rosie, it's okay. I have my documents. And he takes out his passport, his resident book, and gives it. And they put him in a car with some other people. And we're sitting on the ground. They made everybody sit, women on one side, men on the other. And my mother is looking at me, and she said, Rosie, don't say a word. I said, okay. And I said, a few minutes later, this car that took him away came back, but only one person with the driver got out. And a teenager guy came and said, we want all the people from Carver Mission to get up and you can move to the next, you know, you can move on. I said, no, we can't, because they took Anthony,
our friend,
and I don't want him to come back and don't know where we are. He said, what? He was executed. Didn't you hear that gunfire? Oh, my God. My tears. And I'm crying and we're packing up. Then they arrest my stepfather. They arrest our pastor. And another man from our group, I'm saying, God, why did I get out of bed today? Did I not listen to you to stay put? Or was I carried by fear to move? You know, and we were deciding to have gone to my sister Rebecca's parents, but we couldn't. You know, we didn't know what to expect. Every few, maybe a 500 yards, 1,000 yards as a checkpoint. And a little boy around 9 came and looked at me and said, Oma, why are you crying? And I said, oh, they arrested my dad. And he said, let me go and come back and see if you're still crying. I told the pastor's wife, I said, wipe your eyes. He's a small soldier. Let's not show it. And so we're moving. And then I turned to the brother of Anthony that was killed. I said, Brother John, go back to your embassy. Do not go with us any further. You see what has happened. Go back. Your wife and your daughter are Liberian. She will find her way to her village or whatever, but go back. He said, no, I can't. I said, please. But when that little boy said that, he said, I will go. And so he slipped between the houses and left. I've never heard from him, but I'm sure, you know, he went back safely to Carver and then to his embassy. But there were so many things that we were not prepared for. But by the night, we met all the people from ELWA lying in the grass. There was a small stretch of water that, you know, was a checkpoint, and everybody was screened as you went through.
Wow.
Yeah.
How many Rosie were in that group when you were stopped? How many people were traveling?
We were 33 when we stopped. And when our three people, one was killed, leaving us with 32, and then three others, you know, were arrested. But later, my stepdad was killed, you know, as they released them. So we were actually 31 people that made it to our house in Mount Barclay.
Yeah, Rosie, what struck me as I was reading the portion of the book that was about the war was just how, as someone who's only known America, only, you know, I was born in 1972, how we really do forget to be grateful for what we have here, and how the vast majority of us in our age categories have not really lived through any particular really, really hard things. And what you went through was just unimaginable. I know that the one thing that really struck me as I was reading was that I've never really been hungry. Like, I've never in my life really been hungry. And I know, Georgie, that was a chapter that you talked about being particularly impactful for you. Can you tell us about writing that chapter?
Yes. Rosie talked about leading this 33 people. And, you know, one of the things that struck me was the wisdom that she had. Yes. And I knew, you know, we were writing the book together. We started with her draft, and I knew some of these stories, but nothing like when you're sitting there and you're trying to bring to life so that the reader can really be in the story with
experience
you.
Experience
it. I mean, it just affected me, you know, so much more, almost like, wow, like I'm just hearing this for the first time.
Right.
But there's one chapter called What Does Hunger Look Like? Besides the fighting, besides the things that she witnessed, it got to a point where everyone was hungry, even the soldiers. The ports were closed. The farmers had deserted had run away from their farms. The fishermen had left. So all their canoes are on the beach, but there's no fishermen to fish. So really desperate times. And I think this is one of the chapters in the book that I think about. I just think it's the most powerful one. And it's when Rosie was traveling with some of her sisters, and they witnessed two of her sisters' children die from starvation. Because everybody's just trying, you know, they're trying to find anything and looking at plants or different things, you know, that are edible. And there becomes a point after the two kids die that things got so desperate that one of her sisters found some chicken feed. And, you know, they're on the ground picking through the rocks and whatever. And, you know, they're so desperate. They're eating what chickens are, you know, or meant for chickens. Right. And immediately what came into my mind was the prodigal son in the Bible. And how, you know, he was there with the pigs and, you know, was in that desperate situation of his own doing. But and for her and for them, it was not. But, you know, that whole scene, as was really, it really affected me in a strong way. Yeah.
It is an impactful chapter. And I just, and we're just because of time constraints, we're not even touching how deep and artfully written and how detailed the book is. I would encourage every single person listening or watching, please go get the book because we have so much to learn. It is so, it's so impactful. And for me, it was so convicting. I mean, just to think about what we as Americans, the richness of our life and the privilege that we have to live in this country and how, you know, we don't really always stop and think about what people in other countries have endured and championed through and what, you know, how, what they have lived through and gone through. And just, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. But.
And then turn it into a to mission to help
good.
Others.
Like, absolutely. And that's our next point. So most people, many people, after having gone through what something, a situation that Rosie lived through, maybe would spend the rest of their life trying to find comfort or spend the rest of their life just being quiet and trying to enjoy
just heal
some rest
themselves
after all of that. Exactly. But that's not what Rosie did. Rosie, you have gone on to do incredible work for the people and especially the women of Liberia, and you have even founded an organization specifically for women. And we've got to spend some time talking about that. So tell us what you have done more recently.
I had the opportunity to help with rehabilitation of child soldiers.
Yes.
When we left Liberia, we became refugees in Ivory Coast.
Right.
You know, when you're moving from place to place within your own country, you're called internally displaced. Mm-hmm. But when you leave the borders of your country and go into another country, you're a refugee.
Right.
And while I was there, I think it was 2 months after we arrived, one of the American interns that had come to Carver Mission, you know, had gone back to the States because the fighting had renewed, and he got married, and he came back as a missionary under Calvary Chapel, Liberia. And he called me one day on the phone. I got this phone call, and he said, "Ma, we got funding from UNICEF to do the rehab program that you always said we should do." And I was shocked. I said, "Oh, no, Chad, I'm not coming back to Liberia." And he said, "No, but you need to, we have funding now to do rehabilitation." Well, we, you know, I won't go into detail because it's in the book. We started with that. But when the project was over, I felt we still needed, you know, further work to be done. And so after the project with UNICEF, I started, you know, the organization called Touching Humanity in Need of Kindness. THINK is the acronym. This came about because I had done a survey of war experiences of women and girls, and I felt that we had not even touched anything. When people talk about child soldiers, you think of boys and men, you know,
right.
And the little boys who are underage are called child soldiers. Well, we had girls that fought. And my heart went out, and I said I could not hear all of these horrific things and not do anything to help. And so we started THINK primarily to be able to rehabilitate female child soldiers. And from there, we went into sexual and gender-based violence because we had a lot of victims and survivors of that. We went into human trafficking, providing shelter and safety for persons who have been trafficked. And so that is how THINK is moving on. And we work with the Liberian National Police, taking in children who are abused or runaways or missing or, you know, those type of kids through the police system. And so THINK has shelters for, you know, a safe home. And then we have what we call the Juvenile Transit Center to help kids with counseling. And some of them have no exit. So we have about 20 that are permanent residents at the THINK shelter.
Isn't it amazing?
And that's all in Liberia.
In Liberia, yes.
I want to interject in here. My oldest daughter, Taylor, who is now 29, had the opportunity her freshman year in high school to come to Liberia with Georgie Nardi and some other dear friends from our church and experience the country and see where Georgie grew up. And she got to see the THINK House. And she was 15 at the time. And I will never forget, Georgie, you remember this. she was so moved and so overwhelmed, and just, I think it has really stuck with her too. Just how incredibly privileged she is to have grown up with loving parents, a loving father, a protective father, to have been cared for and safe, and to never have been hurt, you know, or abused in any way. I remember she called and she didn't really want to talk to me. She wanted to talk to her dad. Yes. And because she was just sobbing, and she was like, "Mom, these girls, what they have lived through, and it's just so incredible what they're doing for them, and they're giving them a chance at a real life, and these girls are going to be successful." And she goes, "I've never really said thank you, you know, for having been safe." And so, Rosie, I mean, just, you are just such an inspiration to women everywhere. I mean, to have lived through what you've lived through, to have mothered a disabled child and lost her, to have seen the horrific things that you've seen and yet still have hope in humanity, and then turn
and overcome
around
your disability.
Yes, and use your talents to make sure that the next generation of Liberian women have a much better shot is just truly, truly incredible. And I hope you know what just an amazing, inspirational woman you are. You really, really are. And how incredible to watch sisters be able to bring all this to life together. What a gift. I mean, briefly, tell us a little bit about the writing process together.
I had been writing for about 2 years. And 2 years ago, Rosie said, "You know, I've been working on this draft for 10 years. Can you take a look at it?" And I said, "Well, I've just started writing 2 years ago." Okay. So when I, you know, at first I was like, "I don't have time for this. I'm working on my own book." And then when I started to read, you know, through the draft, I was like, "Oh my gosh, I have to help her with this.
You have to write this.
This is
book.
An important story.
I have to, because it's so important. And, you know, this story needs to go out in the world where people can really feel and feel like they're inside the story." So, you know, as we're going through it, we've been working on it for 2 years. I don't know, maybe 5,000 hours or more together.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. I can attest. Georgie was always writing for the
last
year.
Oh, my gosh. I know. My husband's. But so the thing that, you know, I would say to Rosie, okay, you know, asking her question, doing fact checking. But beyond that, I kept saying, "Well, Rosie, how did you feel?" Just kind of, Lise had asked earlier, "How did you feel when you were a little girl?" I had asked the same thing as well. Yeah. And, you know, "And what did this smell like? And what was it like?" Just to kind of try to create a story form out of showing more than just telling.
And letting the reader experience the environment.
And letting the reader tap
us.
Yes. So we are first-time authors.
and did an amazing job. It's a great book.
Well, thank you. And so for me, the thing that has been difficult is, you know, it's published and then we're, you know, she's been recording the audio. And we're like, "Oh my gosh, that's a mistake. And this is a mistake." So not long ago, I heard Alan, who wrote the book Theo of Golden, who, you know, everybody's talking about this book. It's become a phenomenal. And, you know, he did a little talk and he said, "You know, I'm a first time author. And I know there are mistakes in the book." And I thought, wow, okay. It's okay if we have mistakes, because we're not anywhere, you know, near what, you know, he's got going on. So that was kind of hard, and I've had to kind of let that go. And Rosie's been so gracious in, like, she's not seeing mistakes. I'm like, "Oh no, this isn't right." You know, I'll just give one example. So Rosie had a dog named Rennie, and the dog had puppies. Well, two chapters later, the dog is following them along the road, and same dog, and all of a sudden we're calling the dog a he. It's like, okay, the dog had puppies. Now two chapters later, he's a he. So little things like that. Maybe some of the readers don't, you know, won't
pick up. That'll be fun little behind the scene Easter eggs. And I think it's nice that you're leaning into it. And it almost just makes it more endearing and authentic. Your two sisters, that you're coming at it from a place of pure love and authenticity to share an extremely moving story. And I just think from Rosie's beginning, from her biological mother and father, and just all of the way things orbited and aligned through your life with having your own child and bringing your mother back, I just think there's so many beautiful things to find in this story.
So many beautiful themes. There really are. That was what struck me. I mean, and why we wanted to have you all on, because it's so much more than just a memoir of the Civil War of Liberia. I mean, we've got incredible family themes. We've got sisterhood. We've got female empowerment. We've got disability parenting. We have adoption. We have missionary work. So everybody listening, the book is so, so good and so detailed. And we've just barely scratched the surface of what's in there. So everyone needs to read this book. It truly is. And for me, like I said, it was convicting. And it made me think, and it made me think, huh? There's that word.
Yeah.
and also learn about think and how you can support it. I mean, there's women in other countries who are living through so much harder circumstances than any of us can really imagine. And it really made me think we've all got to broaden our perspective and remember what's going on in other parts of the world while we're living our fast paced life over here. So it really is incredible what y'all have done. Mm.
And thank you so for spending time with us and sharing your story.
Yes, it really is. It's just an amazing story. So what is y'all's greatest hope for the mission of the book? Like, and I know that's a big statement, but if you could say in one sentence, what do you want the book to do?
For me is never give up. Never give up. I don't care how daunting or how upsetting things get around you, somebody has gone through that also. Maybe theirs is even worse than yours.
Right.
And I encourage women to mentor younger girls. Even peer-to-peer is important, because having somebody to share your problem with, our people in Liberia say, two heads are better than one. Yes. Sharing your experience with somebody you trust, and being a confidential person, being that confidant.
Yes.
Keep what they say and never share unless you are given the permission to share. That will give each of you, of us, I can't say you, it's all of us, we have to have this little network that we can bounce ideas and things, problems and prayer requests. You know, I've really learned to be a person of prayer. The whole war experience made me to say, God, what do I do now? God, I don't know. You know, I couldn't cry. There were times the tears were right here, but I said, if I cry, my kids will give up. If I cry, these people following me will give up. I will cry in the night when everybody else, where I'll go somewhere by myself, cry, and then I come back. You know, we have to be that strength for them. But God is our strength. You know, and so never give up is what I want to do.
I love that. And I think all of our parents, the majority of our listeners are parents with children with disabilities. What a message for them to hear. What a message for them to hear from such an incredible backstory. I love it so much. What about you, Georgie?
You know, I just think it's really neat that we share our stories.
Yes.
And, you know, I think this is an example, not just Rosie's story, but Lisa and Nikki, your story with Connor and Tanner. I think it's just a perfect example of how God delights in using people the world overlooks.
Yes.
And,
love it.
You know, that's, you know, don't want people to feel like they're alone. And I just, you know, that's
I love it.
What I would like people to take
I love
away
it so much. Rosie and Georgie, tell people where they can find you all if you want to share your social medias and where can they get a hold of the book.
Right now, you can get it off Amazon.
Okay.
And by September, the audiobook should be out.
Oh, that's going
to
be good.
And that will be, you'll be able to purchase that anywhere.
Amazing.
And we have social media.
We can put it all in the show notes too.
Yeah.
You're Georgie Davis Writes, correct?
Yes, that's my Instagram. But on Facebook, I'm Georgie Hungerpillar Davis, which is easy to find because Hungerpillar is not a very...
Yeah, not common. Yeah,
right. And Rosie, is yours Hungerpillar too? Or
Rosanna
is it just
Hungerpillar Shack.
Shack on Facebook.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, everyone go follow them so that you can follow them as they continue to take the message of this book all around, far and wide. We hope everyone gets to hear it. Please, please purchase the book or get it on audiobook if you're a listener in September. And share this episode because more people need to hear this message of hope.
And thank you.
And we are
too.
Just so grateful to you, ladies. This was amazing. I think
thank
I
you.
Really, I'm so happy. I love it that y'all came on. Thank you so much.
Really, I just, this too. Has been a really moving story. I thank you both so much. I'm excited to hear the book. I'm actually going to wait for the audio because I like to listen. But, and Rosie, you're reading it.
Yes.
Yes.
With her accent. Your voice is very soothing. So I'm excited for that.
Thank you.
Very soothing. Well, we love y'all and wish you all the best. And we are just so, so excited to see how many people this book impacts. Thank you for coming on.
Yep, thank you.
We love you, Mina.
It's been a privilege.
Yes. Okay, Lise, I am so glad this worked out today. I was in tears about four times.
I could barely speak. I was just at the edge of my seat. I wanted to hear everything that Rosie and Georgie had to say.
100%. We could have had five episodes.
A few moments that, that really, really, really grabbed me and shocked me. So I hope all of you out there have enjoyed today's episode as much as we have.
Me too.
My biggest hope is that you will share, like, subscribe, write a review, and make sure this episode gets pushed. We feel it is so important. And then support the book, audio, or purchase the book.
Yes. Chosen Warrior on Amazon. Easy to find. And like she said, audiobook in September. Yes, please push this out. Send it to friends. Share it to your stories. Listen to it. Watch it. Whatever you prefer to do. Because these women really, I feel like they just have so much incredible goodness to offer the world. And we really want people to know about them. And you can also follow the work of Think at thinkliberia.com. They're just amazing people. And it just blessed my soul to be with them today. So
who knows what it may inspire you to do or some way that this episode moves you to pay it forward in whatever way that makes sense.
And I just love, I guess the best way to end it up is what Rosie said. It was just another encouragement, as we've all been doing for each other, to never give up. You just never know what God has in store for your life. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a good way to wrap it up. Are you good, Lise?
I'm good. That's amazing. So,
all right. Well, as we always say, you know that we
love you.
Love you, Minute. Everybody have a great week.
Bye.
Pioneer.